Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. Today, I will embark upon a journey through Daniel, starting with chapter 1 in this audio, which I will entitle Daniel Taken to Babylon. I'm going to give you some introduction to the book of Daniel, mainly focusing on the author of the book and the date of the book, because these two issues are fraught with controversy, liberals loving to attack Daniel's authorship and the traditional date of Daniel. So let's start with who the author is. I'm going to give you some authorities who claim that the book is indeed written by Daniel the prophet, who lived in the 6th century B.C. Daniel 7:1 says this, "In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream with visions in his mind as he was lying in his bed. He wrote down the dream, and here is the summary of his account." So right there in Daniel 7, the book itself claims that Daniel is writing down his prophecies. Daniel 12:4, this is God speaking to Daniel, "But you, Daniel, keep these words secret and seal the book until the time of the end." You, Daniel. And so Daniel is claiming to be the author. We ask the question then, was the author a pious fraud? Someone who claimed to be Daniel but who wasn't really? Well, what kind of authority would that kind of a book be? Well, when the liberals get through with it, basically the book has no authority at all, and that's why Bible-believing Christians who believe in the inerrancy of Scripture will gag at such a proposition. Now, what about Ezekiel? Ezekiel, who was a contemporary of Daniel, in fact a fellow exilic prophet, Ezekiel probably died in 570. Daniel made it all the way through the Babylonian captivity, all the way down to 539 when Cyrus the Great beat Babylonia. Daniel even made it beyond that. He ended up working for Persia down in Susa. But Ezekiel, who was Daniel's contemporary, believed Daniel was a prophet and the author of the book. We read in Ezekiel 14:14. Ezekiel says, "Even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it," a hypothetical land Ezekiel was talking about, "they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness." So Daniel is said to be a righteous man. He was the prophet that Ezekiel was very familiar with. Ezekiel 14:20, "Even if Noah, Daniel, and Job were in it, this hypothetical land, as I live, that land could not deliver their son or daughter." So Ezekiel clearly believed in Daniel, that he existed, that he was a prophet. But he doesn't say anything about them being a prophet, but he compares Daniel with Noah and Job, well-known biblical figures. Ezekiel 28:3, Ezekiel says, actually it's Yahweh telling Ezekiel to say, "Yes, you," referring to the ruler of Tyre, "yes, you are wiser than Daniel." Ah, so Ezekiel knew that Daniel was a very wise man because he was working for the Babylonians in the government service, and he was noted for his wisdom and intelligence, as we'll see. So Ezekiel knew who Daniel was. He was smarter than any liberal scoffer that you might run into. I ask you, was Ezekiel an idiot? Was he a fraud? Well, how about this? Jesus himself claims that Daniel is the author. Matthew 24:15, Mark 13:14, the Olivet Discourse. "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation," Jesus says, spoken of by Daniel the prophet. So Jesus thought that Daniel wrote the book. Now, of course, liberals have comebacks to all of this. I'll mention that in just a little bit later. But I think that if you have even a modicum of respect for the Holy Scriptures, you will see that Daniel wrote this book. And Daniel, my friends, lived in the 6th century B.C., so when he was writing prophecy, he was writing prophecy and not history. Now let's look at what the liberals say. They say, no, Daniel did not write the book. Why? Because the author speaks mainly in the third person. Well, so what? Daniel sometimes speaks in the first person. Daniel 8:1, "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me." That's first person. "Even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first." So Daniel not only says that he's writing the book and having the vision, at least, he calls himself me. Daniel 9:2, "In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel," understood by books the number of the years, "I, Daniel," that's first person, not third person. Daniel 9:20, "And whilst I was speaking and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and presenting my supplication before the Lord, my God, the Lord, my God, for the holy mountain of my God." There's a lot of first persons there. Daniel wrote the book. This is a silly argument. Daniel 10:2. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. So Daniel wrote the book, and he wrote it very often in the first person as well as the third. That argument holds no water. I mean, even God himself switches between the grammatical first and third person when speaking of himself. In Exodus 20, verse 2, he says, I am the Lord your God, first person, who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Exodus 27, do not misuse the name of the Lord your God, because the Lord will not leave anyone unpunished who misuses his name. He could have said who misuses my name, but he says misuses his name. Third person, first person, big deal. All right, so that argument is absurd. Let's look at another argument the liberals might use against the authorship of Daniel. The liberals say the book was written in the Maccabean era, that's 2nd century B.C. instead of the 6th century B.C., and that was long after Daniel was dead. The liberals say, how else could Daniel have such specific historical references? Now, I'm going to talk about this when I get to the date of the book in just a minute, but when we get to Daniel 11, the kings of the north and the kings of the south, that's talking about the 6 Syrian wars between the Syrian successors, the Seleucids, the successors of the kingdom of Alexander the Great, fighting the Ptolemies, another one of the successors of Alexander the Great, and boy, is it precise. It's really fun to go through it. So the better the prophet that Daniel is, the less the liberals believe in him. Oh, a prophet couldn't do that. He couldn't be that precise. Has to be somebody else. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Now, let's look at the liberals' defense against these references of Daniel, Ezekiel, and Jesus, referring to Daniel being the author of the book of Daniel, these references that I just gave you. Some liberals say that Ezekiel is referring to an ancient Canaanite hero from their pagan mythology named Daniel, namely Daniel, the son of Akkad, who was a Baal worshiper. Now, how ridiculous is that? This shows the utter absurd extent to which liberals will go to deny biblical prophecy. Ezekiel refers to Noah and Job and Daniel, the son of Akkad, a Baal worshiper. I mean, come on. Now, a more reasonable defense, I think, referring to Jesus' reference to Daniel the prophet in the Olivet Discourse, thus proving that Jesus believed that Daniel wrote the book. The liberals could say, well, the reference that Jesus makes to Daniel is to the book of Daniel, not the person in the book of Daniel. It could have been written by somebody else who falsely claimed that he was Daniel. Now, I'm just speculating that liberals say that. I actually have not read such an argument. I just put myself in their shoes and try to defend them. Well, this is what I would say to that. Jesus said Daniel predicted the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. Matthew 26:64. You have said it, Jesus told him, that's the high priest. But I tell you, in the future you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of the power and coming on the clouds of heaven. And if you believe, that's referring to the coming of the Romans to destroy Jerusalem in A.D. 70, as I do because I'm an Orthodox preterist, then that means that Daniel predicted A.D. 70. So it doesn't matter whether he was living in the time of the Maccabees, 2nd century B.C., or in the time of the Babylonians, 6th century B.C., he still was a prophet. Now, of course, Jesus, when he was speaking to the high priest in Matthew 26, he was quoting Daniel 7:13, which says, I continued watching in the night visions, and I saw one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was escorted before him. One like a son of man, of course, was Jesus. Daniel was prophesying about Jesus, and Jesus quoted the prophecy. He quoted Daniel the prophet. So I don't believe that Jesus thought that Daniel was a pious fraud, and he's just going to quote him, even though he's a pious fraud. All right, so I think we've established pretty comfortably that Daniel is the author. Now let's look at the date of the book. The traditional date is the 6th century B.C. As I said, Daniel, of course, was taken into exile in 605 B.C., and he spent his years from 605 to 539 when the Babylonian Empire died to the attack of the Persians. He spent all of that time, all of those years in Babylon, working for the Babylonian king. And he also survived afterwards and worked for the Persian king after 539. Now, we know the dating of Daniel because Daniel tells us during which king's reigns he had his dreams and visions. He mentions Nebuchadnezzar by name at one point. Let's take him at his word and don't think that this is some kind of donation of Constantine fraud. Well, let's look at the liberals' Maccabean late date theory. The Maccabeans, of course, fought against the Seleucids, the Syrian successors to Alexander the Great, who were trying to take over the territory in Jerusalem at various times of that period. And, of course, the Maccabeans were the Jewish freedom fighters who rose up and fought against them and eventually threw off their yoke. Now, if we hold to this liberal view that Daniel wrote at that period, we have to not take Daniel's statements at face value. We have to assume that Daniel is lying. Now, the general statement of the theory goes like this. Daniel wrote during the Maccabean Wars against the Greek successors of Alexander the Great, the Seleucids. He's trying to encourage the faithful Jews to victory, so he writes history in the form of prophecy. So oppressed, pious Jews would think, wow, God predicted victory for us, and so we're going to get it. So that means Daniel is a pious fraud. Well, that's the theory. So let's look at some arguments used by these liberal late daters. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, they say that Daniel could not have prophesied with such precision, especially concerning the Syrian wars in Daniel 11, verses 1 through 35, which we'll look at when we get there. Now, notice the nature of this argument. This is a presuppositional prejudice, a fideistic assumption that prophets can't be prophets. Why can't prophets be prophets? Late daters have been skeptics and rationalists from the beginning. The first person who came up with this late date theory was a Neoplatonic philosopher named Porphyry of Tyre. Actually, he's a famous guy because he's a skeptic. He lived between 234 and 305 AD. And beginning in 1771, influenced by the Enlightenment, academics began to revive the old Maccabean date theory, and now they all believe it. That herd of liberal numbskulls who just will not bend their knee to Yahweh, their creator, and to Jesus, their deliverer, their potential deliverer, if they would just listen to him. All right, so argument number one, the liberals say Daniel couldn't have prophesied with such precision. Argument number two, Daniel has made some historical blunders, they allege. Someone writing in the 6th century would not have made such blunders. Now I'm going to go through five alleged errors, and we'll see if they're errors. Alleged error number one, Daniel gives the wrong date for Nebuchadnezzar's invasion of Judah. Now we know from Jeremiah 46:2 that Nebuchadnezzar invaded Judah. This is his first invasion. Nebuchadnezzar invaded Judah in the 4th year of King Jehoiakim, whereas Daniel 1:1 says it was in the 3rd year of Jehoiakim. Is that a contradiction? No, it is not. Jeremiah used the Hebrew method of reckoning reign dates. Daniel used the Babylonian method. The Hebrew method counted that fraction of a year in which a king acceded to the throne. The year of accession is counted as the first reign year. The Babylonian method left out that fraction of the first year of the accession year. Only the first full year of a king's reign is counted as the first reign year. So that explains the 1 year difference. Now, regarding this issue of the dating discrepancy for Nebuchadnezzar's first invasion of Judah, there's another related issue that liberals like to bring up. The Book of Kings does not record the battle that occasioned the exile of Daniel in 605. That, of course, is the famous Battle of Carchemish, or at least Carchemish was the battle preceding the invasion of Judah, and the Book of Kings does not record this invasion of Judah. The Book of Kings does not record the battle in 605 after Carchemish when Nebuchadnezzar captured Daniel and took him into exile. The answer to that is the Babylonian historian Berossus records it. This is quoted by Josephus. Berossus is. The Babylonian Chronicles in the British Museum describes the battle. That was not published until 1956. By the way, dating, of course, in the Old Testament is enough to make you pull your hair out trying to get all the dates straight. There's a lot of dating issues in the book of Daniel which are too deep for me to go into and for me to understand at this stage of my ignorance. I've accumulated a lot of interesting apologetics articles on various dating issues in the book of Daniel. I'll mention them as I go through the book, but I'm just giving you a summary here of how those problems can be answered to protect the integrity of the authorship of the book being by Daniel the prophet. And of course, the famous battle at Carchemish between Nebuchadnezzar and the Egyptian pharaoh is well attested. And it's just a short hop, skip, and a jump from Carchemish down to Judah. So we're not going to worry about the fact that the Book of Kings does not record this battle, this invasion of Judah, as Daniel does. That's an argument from silence anyway. Now let's go to the second alleged historical blunder that the liberals say Daniel made. Daniel, they say, uses the word Chaldeans to describe a class of soothsayers in Daniel 2:2. But, say, the liberal critics in Daniel's day, the term Chaldean was only used as a racial designation, not a term describing soothsayers. In Daniel's day, according to the liberals, the word Chaldeans described a master race who ruled Nebuchadnezzar's superpower empire. And so for Daniel to use the term Chaldean to describe a class of soothsayers was anachronistic. Only by the time of the second century would the word Chaldean be used as applying to a soothsayer, like Daniel does it. What's the answer to that? Linguistic research has demonstrated that the Babylonian word for an astrologer priest and their word for their supposed master race were homonyms, both having the Chaldean sound Kasdu, but each retaining their own meaning. Alleged historical error number three that the liberals say Daniel made. The account of Nebuchadnezzar's madness when he started acting like a cow and started eating grass is obviously legendary. Well, it's the easy answer to that. Boanthropy is a recognized psychological disorder, just like the disorder that Nebuchadnezzar had. In other words, people today have boanthropy, thinking they're a cow or an ox. I looked up a reference in a pharmaceutical journal, pharmaceuticaljournal.com. And they tell you all about boanthropy. It's recognized in the modern era, a mental illness that Nebuchadnezzar had. Alleged historical error number four that the liberals say Daniel made. King Belshazzar, who was at the feast when the Persians took over in 539 and wiped out Babylon, there was no King Belshazzar in Babylon, the liberals say. When the Persians came, the answer to that is Belshazzar was Nabonidus' regent. Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon, but he was away from Babylon, out of town, pursuing scholarly studies or whatever he was doing. Belshazzar was in charge. And then last of all, the last historical error that the liberals say that Daniel made was that Daniel mentions a figure called Darius the Mede, and secular history can't find Darius the Mede, so the liberals say Darius the Mede does not exist. Gleason Archer, in his Yellow Bible, Old Testament Introduction book, which is a fantastic book, it has a good discussion of who Darius the Mede was. I'll get into that when we get to Darius the Mede. And by the way, Gleason Archer on Daniel is the go-to source if you want to preserve the integrity of Daniel and the integrity of the prophet Daniel. All right, recapping the arguments used by late daters against the authenticity of Daniel. Argument number one, Daniel could not have prophesied with such precision, and it's impossible, they say. Argument number two, Daniel made historical blunders, which I've gone through. And then argument number three, the liberals use a linguistic argument. They claim that Greek words are used in Daniel, which are words that did not come into the Hebrew vocabulary until the 2nd century B.C. Well, lots of luck on that one. You can get in with the linguist and start arguing about when this word showed up and when it didn't. That doesn't convince me of a thing. All right, so now, let's begin with the text of Daniel, starting in chapter 1, verse 1. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, who ruled from 609 to 598, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, who ruled from 605 to 562, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. Again, the third year, I've talked about that already. Jeremiah and 2 Kings say it's the fourth year of the reign of Jehoiakim. A little bit of background history here. Jehoiakim was placed on the throne of Israel by the Pharaoh of Egypt, Necho II. That was in 609, right after Assyria fell in the Battle of Haran, the remnants, the rump empire of Assyria. Babylonians besieged them along with the Medes in 610 at Haran in Syria. Haran finally fell in 609. Nebuchadnezzar, having killed good King Josiah of Judah at Megiddo in 609 on the way up to help the Assyrians. The Babylonians had already beaten the Assyrians by the time Necho got there, and so Necho hooked up with the remnants of the Assyrian troops, came back through Jerusalem on his way back to Egypt, and he installed King Jehoiakim. Now, Necho of Egypt did that in circa 609. Nebuchadnezzar comes down in 605 after the Battle of Carchemish and came down to Jerusalem and besieged Jerusalem. Carchemish is up in Syria on the Euphrates River, not too far north of where Jerusalem was. Now let's look at this Battle of Carchemish. 605 is a very famous battle. May or June 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar beat the Egyptians, and then Nebuchadnezzar chased the Egyptians all the way to Mount Sinai, or not Mount Sinai, I'm sorry, the Sinai Peninsula. Now, either on Nebuchadnezzar's way south or on his way back to Babylon, he besieged Jerusalem. Now, this was the first of three encounters between the kings of Judah and Nebuchadnezzar. We need to keep them straight and remember the dates. 605, Daniel goes into exile. 597, Ezekiel goes into exile. 586, Jerusalem is burnt to the ground. Key dates which it is necessary to remember. Now, why was the siege of Jerusalem interrupted by events? Why did Nebuchadnezzar stop besieging Jerusalem? Well, because his father in Babylon had died, and so Nebuchadnezzar became king while he was besieging Jerusalem or somewhere around that time. And so when Nebuchadnezzar hears about it, he races back to Babylon to secure his succession to the throne. So we go down to Daniel 1, verse 2. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into Nebuchadnezzar's hand, along with some of the vessels of the house of God, and he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels into the treasury of his God. Now, when did Jehoiakim get beaten by Nebuchadnezzar? Well, it sounds like this is talking about 605 BC, the same date at which Daniel was taken captive into Babylon. But Albert Barnes says it was 598. That's when Jehoiakim was killed by the Babylonians in the second siege of Jerusalem by Babylon. Now, what happened to Jehoiakim in 598 is a matter of conjecture. Here's what Barnes speculates. Jehoiakim was taken captive, and it would seem that there was an intention to convey him to Babylon, but that for some cause he was not removed there but died at Jerusalem, though he was not honorably buried there. We went into all that when we were in the book of Jeremiah, if you might recall. But I'm going to assume that the date is 605. The Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand in 605 as Nebuchadnezzar came back down from Carchemish, and he passed through Jerusalem either on the way back to Babylon or on the way down to whipping up on the Egyptians. And in this 605 exile, along with Daniel, to Babylon went the vessels of the house of God. Now, these vessels of the house of God, of course, had been rendered holy to the Lord through the Levitical ritual, and so it was particularly offensive to have those vessels removed to serve a pagan god in Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar is basically saying when he put these vessels in his treasury, the treasury of his God, Nebuchadnezzar is saying, my God is better than your God. All pagan kings of the ancient Near East did that. They loved to put captured idols in their temples. And of course, the Israelites didn't have an idol in their temple, so Babylon had to make do with captured vessels rather than captured idols. These vessels were taken to the land of Shinar. Shinar is just another name for Babylon. We go now to Daniel 1, verses 3 through 5. The king ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his court officials. This is Nebuchadnezzar now we're talking about. Nebuchadnezzar ordered Ashpenaz, the chief of his court officials, to bring some of the Israelites from the royal family and from the nobility, young men without any physical defect, good-looking, suitable for instruction in all wisdom, knowledgeable, perceptive, and capable of serving in the king's palace, and to teach them the Chaldean language and literature. Chaldean, of course, is Babylonian. The king assigned them daily provisions from the royal food and from the wine that he drank. They were to be trained for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to serve in the king's court. So we see that not only was Daniel taken into exile, but also his three friends, which will be named later, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, their Hebrew names, their Babylonian names being Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, which you might remember from your Sunday school songs. So we see in the 605 exile to Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar took the big shots, the nobility, Israelites from the royal family and from the nobility. So I guess we figure from that Daniel was a noble guy. Young men without any physical defect, good looking. Isn't that the way nobility usually is? Suitable for instruction in all wisdom. So not only were they physically beautiful, they were smart in their heads. They were knowledgeable, perceptive. And they were capable of serving in the king's palace. They became court officials in Babylon. And, of course, Nebuchadnezzar wanted to teach them the language, the Chaldean language, the Babylonian language, and also their literature. He basically wants to make them Babylonians. Now, this was smart on Nebuchadnezzar's part. He held these noble Israelites hostage against a revolt by the Israelites back in Judah, because if the Israelites back in Judah revolted, he'd say, okay, I'll just kill the nobles I have here in Babylon. So maybe you guys better think twice about revolting against me. Now, feeding these Jewish nobles royal food was a special honor In the ancient world, there was a huge difference between king's food and common people's food, as you might well imagine. John Calvin said that Nebuchadnezzar knew that the Jews were stiff-necked and obstinate, so he knew serving royal food to the Jewish nobles would soften up the Jews a little bit. That actually makes a lot of sense, a lot of political sense. So Nebuchadnezzar planned to train Daniel and his three friends for 3 years, teach them the language. Learning a foreign language in 3 years, that's not bad. And also the literature and also the procedures of the court. And then they were going to be servants of the king as royal officials. So we go down to Daniel 1, verses 6 through 7. Among them from the descendants of Judah. Now, among them, that means there were more than just Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. There were other nobles, too, who were being trained for their jobs. Among them from the descendants of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The chief official, that's Ashpenaz, gave them other names. He gave the name Belteshazzar to Daniel, Shadrach to Hananiah, Meshach to Mishael, and Abednego to Azariah. Now, why did Ashpenaz do that? Well, his purpose was the same as the purpose of the king giving food and education to the Jewish noble youths. He wanted to totally indoctrinate them into Babylonian culture. Because to name something means the namer owns the thing named. Think about Adam naming all of his animals. When you give a name to something, you own it. When you put your name on your algebra paper before you hand it in, that means that paper's yours. Just like in prisoner of war camps, you're not going to use your name. You're going to be a number from now on. Naming somebody shows power over that person. And so the Babylonians wanted to show power over the Jewish youths. Now, changing the names not only shows power, but it also shows a switch from godliness to paganism. Daniel, his Hebrew name means God is my judge, Yahweh is my judge. His name was changed to Belteshazzar, which means Bel's prince. Bel being a chief Babylonian deity. Hananiah's name means beloved of the Lord, beloved of Yahweh. He was changed to Shadrach, which means illumined by the sun god. Mishael, his name means who is as God, who is as Yahweh. His name was changed to Meshach, who is like Venus. That's a Greek name. I don't know how Meshach ended up being who is like Venus, but I guess it's the Babylonian version of Venus. Azariah, his Hebrew name means the Lord is my help. His name was changed to Abednego, which means servant of Nego, which I assume is a Babylonian god. So now the Hebrew youths are eating pagan food, drinking pagan wine, and they've got pagan names, and they're being educated into pagan literature, and they're learning a foreign language. So we go now to Daniel 1:8. Daniel determined that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine he drank. So he asked permission from the chief official, that's Ashpenaz, not to defile himself. Now, why would Daniel be defiled by eating the king's food? Well, there were three reasons. That food was not kosher. It had not been blessed by the priest, I guess you could say. It had been sacrificed to idols. It implied fellowship with Babylonian culture. As Joyce Baldwin, a commentator on the book of Daniel, says, by Eastern standards, to share a meal was to commit one's self to friendship. It was of covenant significance. Now you might ask, Daniel didn't object to his name change to Belteshazzar. He didn't object to being educated in Babylonian culture and politics and government. Why did he object to the food? Well, Daniel could have said, look, you gave me a Babylonian name, fine, you can call me what you like, I know who I am. I'm not Bel's prince, Belteshazzar. As far as the education, Daniel could have said, hey, you can teach me what you want. I know what I believe, kind of like when I went through the pagan government schools in America. They were trying to teach me evolution, and I'm laughing at them the whole way. But now, when you ask me to eat meat sacrificed to idols, that's a direct violation of the Old Testament law. I actually don't have a cite for that, but we can assume that Daniel thought that was a violation of the Old Testament law. And so he says, enough is enough. I'm not going to do that. Now, as far as the wine that Daniel wasn't going to drink, that didn't violate the Old Testament law to drink pagan wine, but it was used for libations in Babylonian pagan worship. It's close enough. Daniel says, nope, not going to do that. Daniel really had no choice to stop his name change. They're going to call him what they're going to call him. And he had no practical option to refuse Babylonian education. He had to survive in Babylon. He had to be a court official. But he had a practical way to stop eating the king's food, which is by substituting the king's food with other food. Now in verse 8, we see that Daniel asked permission from Ashpenaz not to eat the king's food. He explained the reason why he declined the food later on. Well, not later on, but right here in verse 8. He asked permission not to defile himself, so he told Ashpenaz, this is why I'm not eating the food. It's not because I'm ungrateful or I don't like the food, this foreign food I'm eating. It's because this defiles me according to my religion. Daniel didn't want to sound obstinate or rude, and so he explained why he didn't want to eat the king's food. Now, this was a remarkably courageous request. What kind of punishment was hanging over Daniel's head? Here's the type of king Nebuchadnezzar was. He murdered the sons of Zedekiah in 586, right before the king's eyes, then immediately gouged out the eyes of Zedekiah so that Zedekiah's last memory would be the murder of his sons. We read that in Jeremiah 39, verses 6 through 7. At Riblah, that's up in present-day Lebanon, staging area, on the way to Jerusalem and on the way back that the Babylonians used, at Riblah, the king of Babylon slaughtered Zedekiah's sons before his eyes, and he also slaughtered all Judah's nobles. Then he blinded Zedekiah and put him in bronze chains to take him to Babylon. So Nebuchadnezzar was no pushover, and Daniel is taking a step that one could reasonably foresee would really tick off Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar also roasted some false prophets of Judah over a fire. Jeremiah 29, verse 22, based on what happens to them, all the exiles of Judah who are in Babylon will create a curse that says, may the Lord make you like Zedekiah and Ahab. That's not King Zedekiah, that's a false prophet. Ahab was another false prophet. May the Lord make you like Zedekiah and Ahab, whom the king of Babylon roasted in the fire. Zedekiah was no shrinking violet, and Daniel standing up to him. He could have spoiled all chances of advancement. After all, other of the Hebrew youths did eat the food, we can suppose. Daniel and his three friends did not, but there were other Hebrew youths being trained for the government service, and they probably ate the food. Eating vegetables and water for 3 years was not an attractive prospect, especially when you compare that kind of food with the royal food. Also, think about Daniel. He's separated from his family. He's separated from his home. He's in exile. He's beaten down psychologically. It would have been very easy for him to compromise. Well, who's going to see me here? What Jewish rabbi is going to know what I'm doing? Also, it would have been easy to pout and blame God for letting him get in the awful fix he was in. But Daniel shows how it is proper to act under oppressive circumstances. He courteously requested of Ashpenaz that he not eat the royal food. He backed up his request with a winning life, which comes later, as we'll see. And he made up his mind beforehand he would not be compromised. Verse 8, Daniel 1, Daniel determined that he would not defile himself. He was resolute in his purpose. Daniel's a good guy. We go down to Daniel 1, verse 9. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials, that's Ashpenaz. So God worked through the wise actions of Daniel to get the officials' goodwill. Not just Ashpenaz, but also the other officials we can presume. So Daniel was an excellent prophet. He was an excellent government official. He was an excellent worshiper of Yahweh. Now God did grant Daniel favor, but we can assume that this was not arbitrary. It was because Daniel had done that which pleased God, and so God gave him favor. We go now to Daniel 1, verses 10 through 13. Yet he said to Daniel, that's Ashpenaz, the commander of the officials, my lord the king assigned to your food and drink. Ashpenaz's lord the king, of course, is Nebuchadnezzar II. I'm afraid of what would happen if he saw your faces looking thinner than those of the other young men your age. You would endanger my life with the king. So Daniel said to the guard whom the chief official had assigned to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then examine our appearance and the appearance of the young men who are eating the king's food and deal with your servants based on what you see. Now, why was Ashpenaz afraid if Daniel quit eating the royal food? Well, he's in charge of Daniel and the three friends of Daniel, and it wouldn't look good if Daniel and the three friends started looking sickly. The king of Babylon's going to say, what's going on here? You're in charge of these guys. They look like they're about to die. How can they be my good government officials? Nebuchadnezzar might think. Now Daniel saw the legitimate concerns of the eunuch of Ashpenaz. He wasn't going to let Ashpenaz pay the price for Daniel's conscience. Also, Daniel didn't go on a hunger strike and start throwing over banquet tables and saying, no, I'm not going to eat the king's food until you give me something else. He didn't do that. he came up with a supernatural solution. He tells his guard, that's probably not Ashpenaz, but it's another guard who's assigned to guard Daniel, let's test us. Test your servants for 10 days. Servants is Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Test us for 10 days. Give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. And then see how we look compared to all the other carnivores who were serving the king of Babylon. Now, was Daniel putting God to the test? No, he was trusting in God, having been put in a difficult place. He was not arbitrarily asking God to do miracles just to show that Daniel could do a miracle. He wasn't following the suggestion of the devil and then asking God to do a miracle like in the wilderness when Jesus was tempted. There's a big difference in an illegitimate test of God and a trial from God. Testing God illegitimately means putting yourself deliberately in a bad place. A trial means you are put in a bad place through no wish of your own. And that's what happened to Daniel. He was put in a bad place. He didn't try to put himself in a bad place just so he could show that God could do miracles. He needed help. He needed a miracle. Now, Daniel's a prophet. He must have heard from God about this. So why just vegetables was he eating? Because the meat would have been sacrificed to pagan Babylonian idols, and so vegetables would be the only thing to eat. They would not, of course, be involved in pagan worship. We go now to Daniel 1, verses 14 through 16. He, that's the guard of Daniel, agreed with them about this and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, they looked better and healthier than all the young men who were eating the king's food. So the guard continued to remove their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. God gave these four young men knowledge and understanding in every kind of literature and wisdom. Daniel also understood visions and dreams of every kind. At the end of the time that the king had said to present them, the chief official presented them to Nebuchadnezzar. Now at the end of 10 days, they looked better and healthier than all the other people who were eating the king's meat. Now, a vegetarian diet might not make one look worse than someone on a normal diet. Not for 10 days. You're not going to see any worse condition in 10 days if you just eat vegetables and water. But eating vegetables and drinking water for 10 days would not make you look better and healthier than everybody else. So there's where your miracle is. That's what's supernatural. Now, in verse 17, God gave these four young men knowledge and understanding. A couple of options as to how God did that, supernaturally, directly. Some people say God gave them wisdom and understanding because they didn't eat meat. They were vegetarians, and that made them wise. I don't believe that any more than I can fly to the moon. Now, the four young men had knowledge in every kind of literature and wisdom. They knew how to perform statecraft, and they knew all about Babylonian literature and so forth. But Daniel was different at the end of verse 17. Daniel also understood visions and dreams. He was the prophet amongst the four. Visions and dreams of every kind. Of course, as we go through the book of Daniel, he's going to prove that over and over again. Now, in verse 17, these four were wise and understanding and in every kind of literature and wisdom. This is pagan Babylonian literature and wisdom. The four were immersed in Babylonian culture and education, but even though they were in Babylon, they were not of Babylon. They remained true to the God of their fathers throughout their lives. This, of course, provides a good role model for those living in the Banana Republic, which might allegorically be labeled the United States of Sodom and Gomorrah. We go now to Daniel 1, verses 19 through 21, and we will be finished with Daniel chapter 1. The king interviewed them. That's Nebuchadnezzar interviewed Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, and among all of them, no one was found equal to Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So they began to serve in the king's court. So they passed their education, their training, and now they're government officials. Verse 20, in every matter of wisdom and understanding that the king consulted them about, he found them 10 times better than all the diviner priests and mediums in his entire kingdom. Now, Babylon is noted for astrology and the occult, and these magicians, these diviners, who also call themselves priests of some Babylonian god, and mediums talking with the dead, they're obviously demonic. But the wisdom of God is 10 times better than the wisdom that demons provide. Demons do have a little bit of wisdom. 10 times. 10 times more than their wisdom was the wisdom of our four friends. Verse 21, Daniel remained in Babylon until the first year of King Cyrus. Now Cyrus, of course, is Cyrus the Great, who ruled Persia between 559 and 530. The key date with Cyrus the Great is the date he conquered Babylon, on the night of Belshazzar's feast, which we will get to in this book of Daniel. That happened in 539. That's a solid date. Everybody agrees on that date. So Daniel, having left Jerusalem in 605, all the way down to 539, no court intrigue got him. Nebuchadnezzar never got mad at him and put him in jail or exiled him or executed him. And Babylonian kings were tyrants who thought nothing of killing their staff and advisors. Daniel even survived the worst kind of hostile takeover when the Medo-Persians conquered Babylon in 539. Daniel ended up serving the Persians down in Susa, down in southwest Persia, where he died. Never went back to his home. He was a survivor. And this shows that skills and excellence can overcome a lot. Can overcome racial discrimination, country discrimination, religious discrimination. And so the application here is, no matter where we find ourselves, no matter how hostile the environment, for example, communist China, communist North Korea, corrupt and pagan America, no matter what our surroundings are, we can stay loyal to Yahweh and stay loyal to Jesus. Ladies and gentlemen, with that exhortatory note, we are finished with Daniel 1 and are prepared to go to Daniel 2. I will entitle chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar's Dream of a Four-Metal Statue. This will be a fun chapter. I hope you stay tuned with me for that, and I hope you enjoyed our exposition of Daniel chapter 1. See you next time.